May it please the court. My name is Aaron Stubwood, senior attorney at the Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and here on behalf of the Delaware Riverkeeper Network and the Delaware Riverkeeper as petitioners in this matter. Ultimately, the Delaware Riverkeeper Network here makes two primary claims regarding ways in which the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, has violated the National Environmental Policy Act. And while neither is dependent on the other, they do somewhat inform the other and dovetail. But one does not preclude finding for the other. Our first claim here is that the Commission violated its duty to provide a brief discussion of reasonable alternatives. And the reasonable alternative here was what is known as the compression alternative.
Just so I'm clear about that.
Yes.
You didn't raise this issue in the petition for rehearing. So your argument is not that they didn't reasonably discuss it. It's that they didn't reasonably discuss it in light of the existence of the draft EA. Is that right?
So our argument is that what happened here, we had, at the time that we submitted our request.
But there's a back and forth in the briefs about what you're arguing. And I understood in your response that you agreed you were not arguing one thing. You want to say what it is you're not arguing so that's clear?
Yes. So what we're not arguing is that at the time of the rehearing request, we should have brought up the fact that the compression alternative should be in the environmental analysis. Our argument here is that we did not have before us the only factual findings in the record regarding the compression alternative. We had no access to that information. We didn't know it existed. In fact, the entire substance of why the compression alternative should be reviewed, we couldn't have commented on in the rehearing request, and it was
in Tennessee's application, right?
So the compression alternative was brought up in Resource Report 10, which is the part of the application. It's not a document generated or by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. The only finding of facts.
And it addressed compression.
And it did discuss compression in a more abbreviated fashion than what we see in the draft environmental assessment. In the application itself, there's no express statement that it was technically feasible. There's no express statement that it met the purpose and need of the project. And there was little to no discussion about the potential environmental benefits. And also what the economic practicality of it is. All of that was absent from the TGP's submission.
The company submission was that the looping was more environmentally friendly than the compression. Because they would have had to clear new areas for the compression station and such, right? That was their submission.
So I don't know that's not even reflected in the draft environmental assessment either.
But the final agency order cites with approval the company submission.
It cites to...
So if the company submission has an articulation of why looping is a better alternative than compression and the agency embraces it, why isn't that sufficient?
That is not what is required under NEPA. What is required under NEPA is a brief discussion of the alternative, and a brief discussion is what you see in the draft EA, or even what you see, something that takes, several pages that actually discusses the issue, whereas there was no brief discussion other than perhaps maybe a footnote to one page of the applicant's submission.
No, it's not in the four corners of the certificate order, no question about it.
Right.
There's a site back to Resource Report 10,
right,
which has, it's a page single-spaced, and it weighs pros and cons. I haven't seen a lot of these things, but if this were the agency order on explaining environmental pros and cons of the alternatives, it doesn't feel arbitrary and capricious to me. It just lays out.
I think it certainly does in the context that their previous only other finding of fact that they wrote out in the draft environmental assessment said the exact opposite. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission staff.
Staff, exactly.
Staff writes the, from my understanding.
You're saying that an agency is caught in hopeless contradiction if there's disagreement between the staff and the agency itself?
Where there is no explanation as to why there is a complete reversal between the recommendations and only factual findings on the matter.
I think that's quite a change in administrative law doctrine.
So
agencies are certainly found arbitrary capricious for self-contradicting themselves, but they usually aren't found to have acted arbitrarily and capriciously for disagreeing with their staff.
So I would submit
and even failing to explain their disagreement with their staff.
I suppose that's the issue is the lack of a record on the evidence that this project is not does not meet the purpose and need of the project, is not economically practical or feasible.
Is there any requirement that draft EAs be published?
No.
So it was,
at least not for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
So it was entirely fortuitous that this came your way.
Yes, and that's.
And what does it really add besides a sort of rhetorical peg to your claim? The claim which existed at the point where the issue was resolved in the initial order of the commission.
So I think there is an advantage, despite the fact that the project is now constructed and in operation. There is still value in having the agency explain properly what the compression alternative was. The agency now contradicts itself in its own briefing as to what it is.
We're talking about your reasonable grounds, Benny, for a delayed petition for rehearing. And it turns entirely on the existence of this document, staff document, that fortuitously fell into your hands. Not on the actual substance of the alternative.
I think the substance of the alternative, when properly considered, it's hard to come to a different conclusion other than it's not that really is and would likely be the preferable alternative because it impacts far fewer resources in all capacities by every metric.
Now, that doesn't seem to me the reading of the draft EA at all.
The draft EA considered it to be comparable. It said they would be comparable in environmental impacts. I would have liked to have challenged that notion in a comment.
You could have challenged the position taken by the pipeline.
They didn't say anything about its environmental, whether or not it was environmentally comparable or better or worse. That would be something written by, obviously by the applicant. Here, the EA is required to have a discussion of reasonable alternatives,
happen. How do you deal with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership case?
So with regard to...
Well, that case says, I'm going to read you two passages. One says, before the district court, appellants also sought to introduce evidence about a draft EIS that discussed wind energy development. Appellants plan to use the evidence to argue that the Atlantic Rim Project's cumulative impact analysis arbitrarily and capriciously failed to consider the impact of the wind energy development projects. The district court, however, excluded the evidence, which was not a part of the administrative record. The court therefore refused to entertain the appellant's claims based on that evidence, and we upheld that. And another part of the opinion, we say the fact that the Bureau has in the past provided draft EAs for public comment in some circumstances does not compel them to do so in every instance. So in that case, we both held that they didn't have to publish that draft EA, and we also held that because it was not part of the administrative record, it didn't have to be addressed by the agency. Isn't that exactly what we have here?
Right now, the draft EA is part of the certified administrative record that was submitted to this court.
No, but it wasn't part of the administrative record, by which we mean the record in the case and put on the record. It wasn't put on the record at the time of the decision, was it? It's only here because you found it in another matter.
And we submit that that it should have been. In fact,
I'm asking you, why should it have been in light of Theodore Roosevelt?
I think so the draft environmental assessment came to specific conclusions on issues that were not later addressed. I don't know the specifics of what was or was not considered in the final draft the final environmental impact statement in Theodore Roosevelt.
But the court held the draft, at least in that case, and it seems like as a general matter that draft EAs or draft EISs don't have to be put on the record and can't be argued from. What makes this one different? I mean, in that one, they wanted to raise an argument about wind energy, and they weren't able to because it was only in a draft EIS, and they hadn't raised it otherwise. What makes this one different?
So there are the cases that we cite to, for example, the Wilderness Society case, found that where the government takes a position and makes a finding of fact on that position, and later the agency later comes to the exact opposite conclusion. Again, this is staff changing their mind. There needs to be some reasonable explanation as to why that happened.
Was the first one a final agency decision? In Wilderness?
Was the draft EA a final?
Was there a draft EA? In
it was a draft, yes.
And was that put on the record?
I don't know if it was put on the record in that case. But again, I just would like to make clear that it is also staff disagreeing with itself, right? So you have the staff writing the draft EA and the staff coming to the conclusion in the final EA that the compression alternative would not meet the purpose and need of the project.
Is it only a staff decision in a final EA? In a final EA, it's the agency decision.
So the staff drafts the EA. The commission order is what's adopted by that's the commissioners adopting the findings in the environmental assessment.
Right, so at that point you have a final decision by the agency.
Right.
Not just a staff decision anymore, they've adopted it.
They've adopted it, correct.
Could we jump to the segmentation?
Sure.
And particularly the question of how, in your view, typing out previous objections to the possibly foreseen outcome is different from incorporating them by reference in a request for rehearing.
Do you mean in the context?
What is your substantive distinction between this case and Allegheny?
So I guess your question is what substantively could we have learned or what value would be added in considering them together?
No, I'm asking you, what is the difference between saying we object on the following grounds and then typing in what you said before and saying we object on precisely the grounds set forth before at such and such a place.
Sorry, I apologize. You're getting to the jurisdictional argument.
Yes.
So there was very specific allegations regarding segmentation that we made in our rehearing request, 24 pages worth of them.
And your thought is that the nothing that the commission said was in any way a useful defense of its outcome?
No, our position was that they didn't satisfy our arguments. They didn't adequately respond to our arguments, and therefore
wouldn't it have been useful to a reviewing court to point to the inadequacies of the response
of the order itself?
Yes,
which we say are exactly the same. There was no change in how they're responding to our arguments, even now.
It doesn't seem to me that Allegheny took such a charitable view of incorporation by reference.
It said
it was a jurisdictional failure, period.
Yeah, and so that's why we wanted to make very clear in our rehearing request that we made very clear in the rehearing request that they didn't properly respond to our allegations here. And frankly, the rehearing request at FERC has come to the point where it is essentially a formality. I'm unaware of a single
petition.
Well, you say
it's a formality. I have to say, I've found reviewing these cases that very often what the commission says in the order on rehearing is much more revealing than what went before because of the provocation of the request for rehearing.
Our arguments as we framed them in the EA didn't change. There was absolutely no difference between there's no daylight between what we argued were the deficiencies in the EA and their response, because there could be none in our opinion. There could be no adequate explanation for how these products were not improperly segmented. The review was improperly segmented.
Further questions from the bench? Thank you.
May it please the Court, James Danley on behalf of the respondent, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. I would like to, I believe that our briefs should carry the day and more than adequately represent our position, but there are a couple of things I'd like to take a minute to address some potential confusion to clear up. First, the resource report that was attached to the application in page 1016 of the resource report, that's at J132, contains a discussion that does in fact include the resource report's determination regarding the environmental consequences of the two fossil alternatives. That's in the final paragraph of 10.4.2.2, saying that even though there are disturbances of vegetation in the looping program, the new project will be allowed to revegetate to minimize and mitigate possible environmental impacts. And that is a fairly clear declaration by the applicant for what it submitted in its resource report. The two main points that I think are worth saying right now is that there seems to be a bit of confusion with terminology. There was no draft environmental assessment. I think that the terminology is kind of bleeding into the terms we use for EISs. What there was an internal pre-decisional staff document, and the idea that that is subject to the same requirements, let's say under State Farm or Brand X, that there has to be some connection made between one position held at one time and a position held later, simply isn't true. This is the, even though there, of course, was no privilege invoked here, the same principles apply. In order for a staff in an agency to adequately undertake its job of reviewing the material before it on behalf of the commission to make submissions to the commission for consideration, it has to be able to bandy about ideas and think and have procedure and process. And there were many drafts, I'm sure, along the way, even though they're not reflected in the record. The commission never made a finding of fact in this so-called draft, this internal pre-decisional document. That was entirely the process that staff, the experts, the technical experts at FERC went through to produce a series of findings that would then be submitted to the commission, the multi-member body that speaks only through its orders, only through its orders.
Why was it sent to the core and the other, or sent, who, it was sent in another case to the core?
Yes, it was, that is not in the record, but my presumption, this predates my arrival at FERC, but my presumption is that it was sent in part of the process of consulting with one of the consulting agencies, going over the alternatives and seeing what it was that the agencies that were involved had to say about the EA as it was being developed.
How did it get in their administrative record?
That I can't say. I do not know, Your Honor. So keeping in mind that this is a draft internal document, I think this has already been highlighted, but that document is legally irrelevant. It cannot serve as a predicate to excuse the failure to meet the jurisdictional requirements of rehearing for the compression alternative. It simply is not relevant. It would be like finding a discovery of any other document that has no meaning, because there is no entitlement for the petitioner to comment on internal staff documents, of which there could be thousands, none of which are relevant to the case.
So let's assume we agree with you on that, and we don't consider the draft. We still have the final order of the commission, which doesn't consider compression, and it just has this citation to the application report, but it's not entirely clear that it's being cited for an environmental proposition. It's cited for the proposition that the project couldn't be satisfied by compression. I mean, why is that arguably perfunctory and ambiguous citation enough consideration of the compression?
So the certificate order stated that there were no reasonable alternatives that would have significantly fewer environmental impacts. It did cite, as you're correct, to the resource report from the applicant. That was one of a series of different alternatives that were in the sentence at paragraph 65 or 66.
Right.
And you were correct that there is not a luxuriation in the subject, but it certainly was directly responded to, and the commission referenced the specific alternative as it was put forth by the petitioner. Given the fact that the applicant had conducted the review, went into detail about exactly how much damage would be caused by it versus the looping proposal, that does seem as though it would satisfy the requirement of examining it and raising it, certainly for the sake of bringing it to the attention of anybody who wishes to further raise the subject. The point is that everybody who is a participant in this case was on notice about the compression alternative from the opening salvo of the process. It was in the resource report. There was an opportunity to bring up the compression that they had already been put on notice for during the project scoping phase at the time the EA was published, and upon the issuance of the certificate order. And at no time was it raised. It was only after this internal pre-decisional document came to light, which the petitioners seek to cast in the light of a smoking gun, when in fact it was never the commission that made this determination. The commission never spoke about it. So I'm also happy to just take one second, if you'll indulge me, to talk about the issue of segmentation and why it is that it is unacceptable to simply recite the contents of the EA comments. What is required is that a request for rehearing state the grounds specifically that caused the aggrievement in the order. And to rehash the exact comments made in the EA could potentially be acceptable if there was a straight incorporation of the EA by reference, but there wasn't one. To give an example, the petitioner says that the EA failed to look at cumulative impacts. That is in their EA comments at 16 to 20, that's JA 350 to 354. The certificate order addresses at length those comments that are submitted by the petitioner. And again, that's at the certificate order at 88 to 90, JA 4041. It says that the EA comported with regard to cumulative impacts with CEQ guidance because, first, there was resource-specific geographic scopes were laid out. The EA determined that the effects would be minimal, temporary, and contained within the adjacent construction areas and right-of-ways, and that the actions located outside the boundaries cannot result in cumulative impacts. Those are substantive responses to comments filed to the environmental assessment. And those are it is the reasoning that would cause the aggrievement, and it's the reasoning in that certificate order that would have to be specifically laid out in the rehearing request to satisfy that jurisdiction.
Do you know any case that's ever held what you just said?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there any case that has ever held what you just said, that it's not possible to simply for a petitioner to conclude that the agency is just not listening and we're just going to repeat what we said before, as long as they do repeat what they said before? Has any case ever held that that doesn't satisfy the jurisdictional requirement?
No, Your Honor, I've looked and there's no case that says that.
Okay. And the statute, all it says is that the objection must have been urged before the commission on rehearing.
No, not quite.
Objection. No objection shall be considered by the court unless such objection shall have been urged before the commission.
Yes. But
doesn't seem like it's a strict preservation and an unusually strict preservation requirement.
So you're citing 717RB there,
right?
The one of the predicates for seeking rehearing or seeking a petition for review is that you have a proper rehearing request. That's 177RA, and it says repeatedly that it is the order that aggrieves. It is the order. Aggrieved by an order 30 days after the issuance of such order, the commission can abrogate or modify its order. It is the order that's at issue, not the environmental
assessment. Well, they're aggrieved by the denial, by the decision. All it says is the the application for rehearing shall set forth specifically the ground or grounds upon which such application is based. This is, 20 pages of specifications about what their problem is. Now, it may well be that their response to your response is too late to make that.
Right.
Maybe that's right. But they can certainly raise the issue already, and we have to decide whether your response answers their original response. But this statute would have to be a lot clearer in cutting off jurisdiction here, because that's what you're asking us to do.
Yes.
The only cases in which we've ever done that before, am I right, are the ones where either there is a express effort to simply say, we incorporate our other arguments, right?
Or we
refer you to our other arguments.
Yep.
And that's all there is, right?
That you are completely correct that there are no cases that go for this proposition that I'm setting forth. I do think that they're tantamount to one another. And we're getting into some nuance here, I realize, and I agree. They're potentially aggrieved by the contents of the EA, and they raise the exact objections again. But the entire NEPA process that goes into informing the decision-making of the commission has a series of steps. One of them is you raise your objections to the environmental assessment to say, here's where we think you made an error. This is what you should consider. The commission takes all of those comments along with the EA and the work that staff did. They look at them, they resolve them together, and then make a determination.
I understand why it would be better from a policy-making point of view if each side would give their explanation, the other would respond to their explanation of their explanation. That's why we have opening briefs, respondents' mm-hmm. briefs, reply briefs. But the question is whether Congress has imposed this here as a matter of federal judicial jurisdiction. That's the issue.
Certainly Congress wanted there to be rehearing is not in every statutory scheme for every agency. They specifically wanted the experts at FERC to be the people to pass on the objections on these highly technical subjects first. The commissioners will have the first crack at seeing what the errors are. That tees up every one of the winnowed down subjects for your review. That is all contemplated in the process. And the reason why in 177RA it says shall state specifically what the grounds are is so that they can produce that very winnowing and to list the errors in the logic.
Does it say anywhere in A that the purpose is to do what you just said? I mean, we generally don't look outside the statutory text.
No, it doesn't. That's true. But certainly case law says, for example, in Bangor, that I'm going to get this not exactly right, but in Bangor it says that the purpose of rehearing is to give the commission an opportunity to bring its expertise to bear so that it is properly presented to the generalist court. So you're right. That is not in the statute, but that is the purpose as case law is developed. I see my time is up here. Do you have
I have one remark about the segmentation. You have a map in the brief,
yes.
Color, no less, showing what it is, which is great. But you didn't have a map duplicating what happened in the 2014 case, and the juxtaposition of those maps would have been very useful to the court.
I appreciate the criticism. Thank you.
And in future cases, you'll give us two color maps.
I will do so.
All right. We have an intervener. You have 3 minutes, I believe.
May it please the court, I have just a few comments to make on behalf of the intervener, Tennessee Gas Pipeline Company. First of all, I'd point out that the commission, as has been stated earlier, the commission did note in its order a reference to the compression alternative and did reference in specifically to the resource report 10 that's in the record at JA-132 and relied upon that. We have to conclude that. And Jay, the resource report 10 was discussed with you earlier. I'd point out in addition in resource report 10, in addition to the environmental distinctions between the compression alternative and the looping, there was also some practical concerns associated with the compression alternative. The practical concerns concerned the additional costs associated with operating the compressor stations, the two compressor stations, and the fuel costs associated with operating those stations.
Does it make any difference that this wasn't done in the EA itself? I mean, it may be a hyper-technical point, but it's the environmental assessment that is supposed to consider those issues.
Well, this is an environmental assessment, Your Honor. It's not an environmental impact statement.
So I know, but it's the certification order that has that cross-reference to your resource report 10.
I think if there is a distinction, the distinction is that the commission was involved in both instances. It's its environmental assessment that it adopted. And in addition, it's its final order is an indication as to what it considered in reaching its conclusions. And I would point out also that this court has found that it will uphold an agency decision of less than ideal clarity if the agency's path can reasonably be discerned, and I think that's the case here. We would agree with the statements concerning the fact that there's no requirement that the commission had to publish the EA, the draft EA, and we agree that it's not technically a draft EA. Unless Your Honors have some questions for me, that's all I have to say.
Apparently we don't. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So you can have the last 45 seconds of intervener's time.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. First, I'd just like to address Judge Williams, your concern about the Allegheny case. I just want to make clear that case involved trying to bring in allegations that were outside of the rehearing request into later judicial review. So in other words, they were asserting in court issues that they didn't assert in their rehearing request. In Allegheny.
Yeah, I think that was one problem. The other problem was that certain problems they raised solely by saying that they'd raised them before and pointing to where they had.
And I think that brings maybe me around to this other point. And we brought up the example of cumulative impacts and the commission's response to cumulative impacts. And one of the main issues that we had was that their cumulative impacts analysis was deficient because it didn't consider or incorporate the destruction that was wrought, as the language in the case law suggests, of the prior 300-2 pipeline projects. None of all of that record evidence that was available to them, even inspection reports that they themselves generated, were not included in the environmental and were not included in the environmental analysis. And that argument didn't change after the hearing order because they couldn't. There was no way for them to change what was in the EA in the order. So that's the type of argument that we make now in court are exactly the ones that we made with regard to the EA.
Further questions from the panel? Okay, thank you. We'll take the matter under submission. We'll take a brief break while the seats are changed.
Mr. Berger, for the audience. please the court, Edward McAllister of the Perlis Law Firm for the appellants. The Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act is only the latest in a long series of laws passed by Congress to deal with and protect the American people from acts of terrorism supported or sponsored by the PA and the PLO. Also this year, the Taylor Force Act was passed, which requires the PA and the PLO to cease payments to individuals who have been convicted of crimes against Israelis or Americans, and to take credible steps to prevent acts of terrorism within their jurisdiction. The ATCA was passed unanimously by both chambers of Congress and then signed immediately by the President. The purpose of the ATCA is to enable Americans to access to courts to bring to justice the terrorists and their supporters who harm them. This is to facilitate the Anti-Terrorism Act, which was passed in 1991, and the case below was brought under the Anti-Terrorism Act. The purpose and the goal of the Anti-Terrorism Act was to deter terrorism by financially penalizing terrorists and their supporters and by financially compensating their victims.
We still have some factual uncertainty whether it will apply.
Yes, Your Honor.
On February 1st, right?
Your Honor, what we would say is that we have identified, according to public records, a single financial account at least, which continues to flow to the PA and the PLO. It's an INCEL account, which qualifies under the ATCA.
Suppose they stop taking Foreign Assistance Act funds.
We have no reason to believe they will. Their briefs...
Maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know yet. So
that's correct,
Your
Honor.
It would seem we can't, at least as of right now, rule in your favor on that basis.
That's correct, Your Honor. Unless the court receives some dispositive statement prior to January 31st, then we believe that the case should be held and remanded to the district court for fact-finding. There are two elements of the statute. One is whether the PA or the PLO are establishing, maintaining, or procuring an office or facility of any kind. And two is whether they're accepting aid under certain programs. And the status quo currently is that they are qualified under both components. But from their briefs, we don't know what the truth of the matter will be on January 31st.
And the office is... An office in New York associated with United Nations?
Yes, Your Honor.
Activities?
Yes. But the statute itself says maintenance of an office, which is more than just simply operating an office.
I'm sorry. Exactly what distinction are you drawing there?
The language used in the ATCAs is quite broad. It's maintenance, establishment, or procurement of any office or facility. The PA would argue that the mere operation of the mission in New York is not a contact that can be taken into effect because of it's there for the purpose of the peace process and under the United Nations. However, the Act is drawn much more broadly than that, and we believe that we could find expenditure of funds revolving around the presence of the mission, which were qualified under the ATCA. But that is an issue that would probably be best decided by further fact-finding.
Is there any argument that insofar as that office functions like an embassy, it's not within the jurisdiction of the United States?
Your Honor, we would have to conduct fact-finding on that issue. We don't have
fact. No, I'm saying assume it functions exactly like an embassy. Would that office be, I think this is a legal question, right? I mean, is the United Kingdom's office in New York for their United Nations delegation within the jurisdiction of the United States, or is it?
Well, Your Honor,
different because of its diplomatic status. I don't know.
I apologize for interrupting you.
No.
In the 90s, in the Klinghoffer case, the court there found that the mission, while it was operating as the UN mission, that there are other subsidiary activities going on surrounding that.
So okay, so fact-finding on that.
Yes.
But just on the legal question, do you have a rifle shot argument that that can't be right because they're not recognized as a foreign state?
Well, it would not qualify as an embassy of another country. The question is whether the UN treaty, what exceptions the UN treaty would devolve upon them. that facility.
And I guess I'm just making the point that we have a good bit of both legal and factual work to do before we could responsibly apply this.
Yes, Your Honor. But if the status quo remains true on January 31st, then the law would allow for district court to assert jurisdiction under the ATCA.
Why would we remand rather than just order a submission, a supplemental submission to this court? And if the answer to the questions I've been putting to you seem pretty straightforward, we could just resolve the issues ourselves, and if it looks messy, we could remand.
Your Honor, this court has procedures that it can take, which I'm sure would be much more, could be more efficient, and I leave that to the discretion of the court. But to your point, there is further fact finding that will have to be done, I believe, by January, before or on after January 31st. When Congress and the President pass a law regarding foreign policy, it requires a respectful review by the courts. There is no national priority than combating terrorism. This statute is a statute that regulates the procedural rights of the parties. It does not regulate the primary conduct of the PA or the PLO. As such, it applies immediately. The PA and the PLO try to argue that the anti-retroactivity presumption of Landgraf applies in this case. However, it does not, because this case only creates or takes away jurisdiction. And under U.S. v. Alabama, where the Congress passed a law while the case was pending before the Supreme Court, creating jurisdiction for the case, the Supreme Court found that that law only regulated the procedural rights of the parties, not their substantive rights. The same case we find here. Many of the PA and the PLO's constitutional challenges fall away when Daimler is examined and we see that the individual still maintains a right to consent or waive his or her right to a personal jurisdiction defense. In fact, in the Daimler case itself, one of the parties waived their right to a personal jurisdiction defense, and the court found that it was at home for the purposes of that case. Waiver is a form of consent, and the Irish insurance...
It has to be voluntary, though.
Yes, Your Honor, voluntary, knowing and voluntary.
And I can certainly imagine some statutes of deemed consent that don't look very voluntary.
Yes, Your Honor, and there's an excellent opinion from the Second Circuit by Judge Carney, Brown v. Lockheed Martin, in 2016. The judge there was looking at a statute which would have exposed a party to general jurisdictions of the courts of Connecticut had a business merely signed on to register in the state. And in fact, if they had not even been conducting business in the state, they were arguing that that created general jurisdiction over that corporation for any party, for any incident. The statute in the Kleinman case is much different. It only exposes the PA and the PLO to specific jurisdiction for this narrow band of cases. It is not a general jurisdiction statute. And furthermore, there is a 120-day period since the enactment of the law. The PA and the PLO have to make a decision. It will be a knowing and voluntary decision.
In addition to the claimant, as I understand it, that there's a tight relationship between the purpose of granting jurisdiction and the purpose behind the benefits allegedly conferred on the PLO and PA.
Well, Your Honor, for decades there's been generous foreign aid given to the PA and the PLO by Congress. But with every grant of foreign aid to the PA or the PLO by Congress, there have also been conditions that require the PA and the PLO to renounce terrorism and to take active steps to combat terrorism within their jurisdiction, and repeated certifications of ongoing efforts.
We're still on this. I'd like you to discuss the waiver of their personal jurisdiction, or I think forfeiture would be correct, the correct term, by waiting until after Daimler to raise it again.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear the
beginning. By not raising the issue again after Goodyear, but waiting until Daimler?
Your Honor, the central issue there is that the district court found that there is no prejudice to plaintiffs by defendants' decision to wait to raise the Daimler decision a year after fact discovery, when the Goodyear decision had come out prior to the end of fact discovery. This imposed a great prejudice upon plaintiffs because fact discovery had ended, and then because Daimler was now the rule in the case, plaintiffs were required to come up with a specific personal jurisdiction
test. I assume that also cost you a lot of money. So imagine this second statute, either hadn't been passed, the ATCA either hadn't been passed, or we rule that it doesn't help you for one reason or another. You would have not, and imagine you also lose under Daimler. I assume if you knew all of that, if you knew that you were going to lose under Daimler, the case would have been over. You would not have spent another 3 years spending money on the discovery, which might not have helped you at all, certainly not on the merits discovery. Isn't that a prejudice to you, all the money that was spent and the time spent in the 3 years?
Your Honor, we engaged in discovery for 5 years.
No, but I'm talking about the time between Goodyear. What's the time between Goodyear and the time that they
June 2011 and January 2014.
Okay, so for 3 years, you spent money, consumed resources, including your time, that you might not have spent if you had known that the case was over because of Daimler. Isn't that prejudice?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, what about the argument that they make that the at-home defense wasn't clear after Goodyear?
Well, Your Honor, if it wasn't clear, they would not have raised it in two separate filings, the same counsel for the same party. Admittedly, in the first filing, they did not go into great detail about the at-home defense. It was a couple of sentences in a Supreme Court brief, but that was two months after the Goodyear decision came out. Later, in another related case called LiveNet v. Palestinian Authority in the Eastern District of Virginia, they spent 5 pages arguing why the Goodyear defense effectively destroyed the personal jurisdiction case of the plaintiffs there. So the PA and the PLO clearly understood what the import of Goodyear was, and they could have raised it earlier, but they did not. They waited until a year after fact discovery had closed, and plaintiffs had just won a critically important order to compel the PA and the PLO to produce documents, internal documents, that identified payments made by the PA and the PLO to so-called martyrs, who are persons killed by Israeli security forces, but in this documentation, they are identified by the PA and the PLO as Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade members.
Usually, on the preservation issue, usually you have to preserve arguments, right, not citations. And just assume, I know you dispute this, but assume for purposes of argument that the general jurisdiction question, what was properly preserved at the outset of the case. Why isn't this nothing more than just there's an issue preserved, then there's an intervening decision that makes the case more helpful for one side or the other, and they move for reconsideration? And it's no different from if Goodyear and Daimler had come down after district court proceedings are completely done and they go up on appeal and cite Goodyear and Daimler, they're going to win. They're not going to lose on forfeiture grounds. They're going to win on the preserved issue of general jurisdiction.
Your Honor, they would have had to raise the issue in motion for summary judgment or prior to trial. This issue would have come up again. And there are decisions that find that technical compliance with Rule 12H1 does not relieve a party from its duty to raise the defense later. When the party engages in a lot of pretrial activity and then trial activity and does not raise a personal jurisdiction defense, especially when the law has changed and there's a new rule of law, this is sandbagging, and it costs the plaintiffs a great deal of prejudice. But as we state,
and the prejudice you're relying on, so your answer to Chief Judge Garland suggests that the prejudice is you spent all this time and effort that you might not have.
That
rings a little hollow where, to this day, you're vigorously pressing a specific jurisdiction argument.
Your Honor, there are multiple forms of prejudice. One form of prejudice is that we were not allowed to construct our discovery right. correctly because...
I get that. That seems to me different.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. Regarding the Anti-Terrorism Act, right, the Anti-Terrorism Clarification Act, I would just end on the question that the PA and the PLO have raised about fair warning. They argue that because the statute isn't being imposed now, they had no way of structuring their behavior properly in 2002. However, in 2002, they knew they could be sued for the conduct that they were sued for, and that's never been in question. And at that, I will sit down for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, may it please the court. To answer Chief Judge Garland's question, Judge Katz's question, and Mr. McAllister's answer about the 5 years of discovery, not only is that not prejudice to the plaintiffs, it is precisely what they wanted. It is what they were begging Judge Friedman to do repeatedly. Let us have more discovery. This from plaintiffs, whose primary argument in opposition to reconsideration was, we need more discovery because specific jurisdiction is intertwined with the merits. The 5 years of discovery does several things. Not only is it not prejudice, the money, Your Honor, that they spent on discovery is money they would have spent taking intertwined merits discovery, getting ready for trial, and it was a huge benefit for the parties and for the court. It is that 5-year record of discovery that allowed...
Why isn't there prejudice for the second reason we were exploring, which is they're doing the discovery, they would have done it anyway, but they're operating on the assumption that personal jurisdiction is off the table, right? The only live issue is a merits question. For purposes of the merits, all they have to do is connect the attack to an attempt to influence Israeli policy. And that's pretty easy to do. That's a lot easier to do than what they would have to do for specific jurisdiction purposes, which is link the attack to an attempt to influence the United States.
Well, Your Honor, I'd question the premise of the interpretation of the ATA, but let me start with this precisely why the abuse of discretion review standard applies. Judge Friedman is much closer to that question, with all respect, to what discovery the parties were taking. And when the general jurisdiction standard was clarified by Daimler, Judge Friedman didn't steamroll the plaintiffs. He said, I'm going to give you every opportunity to tell me.
They had a lot of discovery, and they went to great lengths. They deposed the trigger man in a prison in Israel, and he says something like, well, you know, I was sent to attack Israelis or whatever.
Correct.
That cinches up their merits case.
I don't think so.
So why would they need... Well, it's very helpful for their merits case, so why would they then need to go down this rabbit hole of trying to link the attack to the to attempts to influence the United States?
Well, if I can answer the second question first, I think you put your finger on it precisely when you say it cinches their merits case. Well, the lesson that we have from Livnat in this circuit and from Sokolow in the Second Circuit is that the liability standard under the ATA and the jurisdictional standard under the Due Process Clause are not coterminous. To have jurisdiction as opposed to evidence showing an effort to influence Israeli policy, that may be enough for the merits case, but it's not enough for jurisdiction. What Livnat tells us is there must be a link.
Which may be the source of the prejudice here.
Well, but at first, it's not a link to the United States, so that leaves...
Hold on. So they, at that time, thought they had general jurisdiction and didn't need specific jurisdiction.
Right until
had they known that they needed specific jurisdiction, then they might have sought evidence to show that these two trigger men were lying. It's not particularly surprising that the people who killed people would say they were aiming at soldiers rather than civilians, because the latter is a war crime. So their credibility on this question only matters, doesn't matter with respect to the merits when they thought they had general jurisdiction. It only matters because they didn't know that they needed specific jurisdiction.
sense.
So there's several points in there, Your Honor, if I might respond, which is this is precisely the set of inquiries that Judge Friedman undertook. He said, what is there out there? What else in the ocean haven't you fully boiled on discovery? It is more than just the attackers. It's not a question merely of credibility. There were 7 depositions of the Palestinian Authority and the PLO, including 3 under Rule 30b-6. This is not an issue as to whether the attackers can be held liable under the ATA. It's a question of whether the PA and the PLO can. What Judge Friedman did, and he did it meticulously, was after the general jurisdiction standard changed and general jurisdiction no longer became possible, he said what a district judge should do, which is tell me what you have, tell me what you need. I'm going to give you every opportunity to crystallize your theory. I'm going to give you every opportunity to tell me what additional discovery you need. It was only when he went through that process that he held that, you know what, not only does the evidence uniformly show no link to the United States. He was applying Walden then, but he was anticipating correctly what this court ruled in Livnot. You haven't shown a link to the United States, and in fact, you have proven the opposite of jurisdiction. You have proven consistently from every witness that there was no link to the United States. And that's the jurisdictional question as distinct, Judge Katsas, from the merits question. And that's why he acted well within his discretion in saying, you know what, after 5 years of discovery, enough is enough. I've given you every opportunity. And when you tell me you're prejudiced, that rings hollow in the sense that what else have you been asking me for 5 years but more discovery? And he noted that in his decision when he said the only thing that happened during the intervening years between Goodyear and Daimler was that they got, yes, absolutely, Chief Judge Garland, it cost money, but so does getting ready for trial under any circumstances cost money. That's not prejudice. That's just part of the litigation process.
What about the other part of his argument that wasn't clear that Goodyear was the law until Daimler?
Well, I think Judge Friedman did an excellent job of summarizing the law. He said, first, Wright Miller got it wrong. Wright Miller says Goodyear didn't change the rules. It's just an application in stream of commerce. Has really no general application. And then Judge Friedman pointed to other district court judges in this circuit.
So here the problem is all very nice, but the Supreme Court thought it was absolutely plain. In Daimler, the court says we made it plain in Goodyear. The Supreme Court says Goodyear made it clear. And in Daimler, the court says, instructed by Goodyear, we look at the question of whether they were essentially at home. So at least from the Supreme Court's point of view, it was crystal clear. And with due respect, they are the ones we have to respect and not district courts who didn't see what they had said in Goodyear.
No question, Your Honor. As a matter of law, that's right. And I think with 20/20 hindsight, we all see it, having read Daimler, what Goodyear was meant to be. The question, though, is not whether or not Goodyear changed the standard, with all due respect. It's whether or not these defendants should have apprehended what other district judges and what Wright and Miller didn't apprehend, that now was the time
to make
that
motion.
Didn't
we already hold that in Gilmore?
No, Your Honor, Gilmore dealt with a very different circumstance. I'm glad you asked me that question. Gilmore, we made the argument that even though no 12b-2 defense was ever raised at the outset, we didn't know we should have raised one until after Daimler came out. This is very different. From the get-go, a 12b-2 defense was waived, and to Judge Katz's point,
well,
once
let me
that
ask
has
about
been
raised, this language in Gilmore. Appellees also argue that their personal jurisdiction defense was not available to them until the Supreme Court's decision in Daimler. At the time of Appellee's pre-answer motion in 2002, the legal basis for their personal jurisdiction defense did exist.
It did, and now, that is the distinction between Gilmore and this case.
Why is that? Because they knew, they're saying that in 2002, their personal jurisdiction defense did exist. And their personal jurisdiction defense was that you have to show at home.
Now, the latter part is not correct, Your Honor. The distinction is, in Gilmore, no answer and no pre-answer motion raised a 12b-2 defense. That is precisely the opposite of the scenario here, where 12b-2 defenses were repeatedly raised.
I understand
and rejected
where the waiver occurred, but I'm on the question of whether the at-home defense was available. And looking at what the district court said, the district court says, in Gilmore, defendants based most of their argument on the allegation that until Daimler was decided, the specific argument asserted in their motion that their contacts with the District of Columbia did not render them at home was simply not available. The court says it was available. Our court said it was available.
In the context of rebutting the argument made by my clients in that case that they had no need to assert a 12b-2 defense from the outset. And what this court said was that, no, there was always a 12b-2 defense. Perhaps you wouldn't have won, but you had no excuse for not asserting a 12b-2 defense. That is not only a dramatically different...
I know it's a different argument with respect to what constitutes waiver. It's not a different argument as to what argument was available. The fact that Judge Friedman thought it wasn't available is rebutted by our holding in Gilmore that it was available. I get your point that it's different if you don't raise a pre-answer motion or you don't put it in your answer under 12b. But that's on the question of whether it was available. It seems like we've already decided that.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because I don't think that's what Gilmore holds, with all respect. What it says is it's dealing with the portion of the argument that there was no reason to assert a defense because it would have been futile. What the court held in Gilmore is it wouldn't have been futile. We recognized 12b-2 defenses. It never held that that was the at-home standard in this circuit. Indeed, you would not find a decision out of this court or out of the district court in this circuit applying an at-home standard to a general jurisdiction argument before Daimler came out.
Neither of that is relevant. The court says there was no Supreme Court or in-circuit precedent rendering the personal jurisdiction defense for all practical purposes impossible.
Your Honor, we're saying the same thing.
In other words, the defense was available at the time.
And all that availability goes to, and I think I'm talking past Your Honor, so if you give me a moment, I'll try to be clear. The availability issue, which is what Gilmore addressed, was, is there an excuse for not asserting 12b-2? Gilmore did not decide that the standard at the time was at home. That is the distinction between Gilmore and this case, and indeed Judge Friedman, in his opinion on reconsideration, said Gilmore presents a totally different scenario. And he's right, because the only issue that was dealt with in Gilmore, at that portion that you're looking at, Your Honor, is why it is that in Waldman-Sokolow, our Second Circuit case, the court said, you know, it's okay that you belatedly raised a general jurisdiction defense. Not an at-home defense, a general jurisdiction defense. Because in the Second Circuit, if you had an office here, you were considered to be subject to general jurisdiction. All that Gilmore says is that's never been the standard in the District of Columbia Circuit. It does not hold that the at-home standard was the standard pre-Daimler, and indeed it was not. Judge Friedman cited to a district court decision in a case called Al-Khanani. Al-Khanani was an example of where another district court in this circuit cited...
I don't understand why it matters what one district court or another district court did. That's not what determines whether at-home is a defense. What determines whether at-home is a defense is what the Supreme Court said in Goodyear.
And the only way in which that arises in this case is whether or not that misapprehension of what Goodyear meant, which the Supreme Court reminded everybody about 3 years later, meant that there is no good excuse for having moved for reconsideration 3 years after.
There has to be an intervening change in law. That was the ground on which he resolved the matter, right?
And indeed,
he said there was an intervening change of law. The Supreme Court said there wasn't.
I think the Supreme Court is perhaps... went to the trouble in Daimler to explain what Goodyear meant because of the confusion. But this is not a strict liability issue for my clients in terms of waiver. The question is whether they acted reasonably and whether Judge Friedman in turn abused his discretion in saying that there was a reason for a 3-year delay in raising
the... Is it not a question of law if you thought that there hadn't been an intervening change in law when there actually had been?
Indeed, Your Honor, reconsideration is a matter, part of the reason why the abuse of discretion standard governs.
But isn't it an abuse of discretion to get the law wrong? That's what the court said in Coons.
Yes, but that was not what the district court decided. What the district court decided was that given all of the misapprehension out there in the atmosphere, among district courts, among commentators, among these defendants about what Goodyear meant, that they had a reasonable excuse for not moving for reconsideration until Daimler told everybody, you know, you've got this wrong. We've been trying to be clear about this, that the at-home standard applies. That is the sole context in which that issue arises in this case, and Gilmore respectfully never held that the standard is the at-home standard prior to the time of Daimler. So given that this, the one question where this matters is, did Judge Friedman abuse his discretion in saying it was okay that you waited 3 years? It doesn't matter whether we read the law wrong. Indeed, it's helpful to us that we read the law wrong because that explains the reasonableness of our behavior until not moving after Daimler. And that is precisely why the abuse of discretion standard applies here also, because the district judge is closer to the record, closer to the proceedings, and that's what the courts rely upon district judges to do. Having held that there was not a forfeiture, let me deal briefly with the waiver question. The waiver question, in turn, has been waived in this court. It was never asserted below, despite litigation in 2005, 2006, 2007 on motions to dismiss. The plaintiffs consistently acquiesced in the merits adjudication of the Rule 12b-2 issue. They never argued there was a waiver because it wasn't sufficiently preserved. They can't make that argument for the first time in this court. And indeed, embedded in Judge Friedman's decision on forfeiture is the recognition that that defense was correctly preserved. In terms of jurisdictional discovery, I've already explained why that 5 years of discovery was beneficial, and indeed it facilitated and indeed compelled Judge Friedman's decision that there is no specific jurisdiction. Again, Judge Katz, it's because of the distinction between the liability standard, which might be satisfied by proof of a connection to Israel, versus the jurisdictional standard which requires it. And candidly, Mr. McAllister spent the first 10 minutes of his argument talking about everything but what happened in the district court, so I think that should convey to this court how much confidence he has in his ability to overturn what Judge Friedman did. He should have no confidence in that because Judge Friedman then meticulously applied the results of discovery to conclude there was no specific jurisdiction precisely for the reasons that this court decided in Livnot. Livnot and the theory in this case are lookalikes. For all the reasons that the court said in Livnot, there was no specific jurisdiction because of no link to the United States. There was no link to the United States here. That is what Judge Friedman considered meticulously, and that's why he had such extensive briefing.
I agree with you on all of that, but I'm just not sure they had a fair chance to try to develop that part of the case.
So,
given the way the general jurisdiction issue had played out.
Well, and that's a reasonable question to ask, Judge Katz, and it's a question Judge Friedman asked, but it requires more than the plaintiff saying, you know what, I don't think I've been treated fairly, I want more. What the district judge is supposed to do and what the district judge did here is say, okay, what do you want? And they could never articulate anything other than we want information about their lobbying in the United States and their fundraising in the United States. Jurisdictional discovery doesn't work by saying, I want more. It requires concrete articulation of what you want. What they asked for is a lookalike copy of what the plaintiffs asked for in Livnot. And in Livnot, this court said, it doesn't matter that zero discovery has been taken in that case, that's not sufficient to alter the jurisdictional outcome. So Judge Friedman, a fortiori, made the right decision when he looked at exactly the same jurisdictional discovery request. It is not either the defendant's job or the district court's job to cater to the plaintiffs and say, you know what, take whatever you want. He has to ask the question, as he did, to say, okay, what else and why does it matter? They couldn't meet that. None of this, despite the long opening from Mr. McAllister, can be undone by act.
You only have a few minutes. You want to talk about the statute?
Yes. I was just turning to that, Your Honor, I will. First of all, to your question, Judge Katz, is the plaintiffs read the statute incorrectly in terms of the mission. What the statute says is anybody benefiting from a presidential waiver who then maintains a mission, that's irrelevant because there is no extant presidential waiver for the PA and the PLO. Hasn't been one for a couple of years. The PLO mission to the United States, which required a waiver, has been shuttered. The Second Circuit.
It's a waiver of this 22 U.S.C. 5202, right?
Correct.
Which makes it unlawful for the PLO to establish or maintain any office, headquarters, premises, etc. I assume there has to be a waiver in place, or else how could they have the New York mission or
because,
office?
I'm sorry to cut you off, Judge Katz.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The Second Circuit held in the Klinghoffer case and the Southern District of New York held in the U.S. versus PLO case that a presidential waiver is not required for the U.N. mission because of superseding antecedent obligations the United States undertook in the U.N. headquarters agreement.
I see.
So
okay.
The waiver only ever applied to the U.S. mission, which has now been shuttered. The president must expressly issue a waiver. No such waiver exists as to the PA or the PLO. As to aid, as Your Honor said, Judge Katsas, the PA and the PLO have not made any decisions.
There's nothing you can tell us.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that they're inclined not to take the aid. They are a government. Their deliberations continue. I don't think a remand is required. It's either a yes or no answer on that, and certainly in the first instance, to the extent the court wants
to. You seem to have a dispute, though, about what constitutes aid, right? There's in your brief, you say certain money is not provided directly. It's provided indirectly and to somebody else. Are those not fact questions?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because it's a two-part question. Does the United States give? And that raises the issues that Your Honor asked. And does the recipient disclaim? All the PA and the PLO have to do is say, I disclaim all aid, however, provided that meets the language of the statute. What we say is, even if they could get past those factual hurdles, which shouldn't trouble this court, there are legal reasons why ATCA can't alter the outcome here.
So just on the mechanics, your position is the maintenance of the UN-related New York office can't be a triggering event under this statute for reasons we've said.
Yes,
sir. So the only relevant triggering event is whether or not your clients will continue to accept aid, and that question is one you can't yet answer.
Well, they're inclined not to accept. As Your Honor pointed out, they have another 5-6 weeks right to make that decision. I think that's something we can easily inform the court about. Your Honor, I worry that with your question, I want to call the court's attention to the fact that even though the court allowed the plaintiffs to file a supplemental brief on ATCA, we worried that there wouldn't be time for us to respond to that. We have an extensive discussion of ATCA in our opposition to their motion for leave to file a supplemental brief. Our authority to be answering those questions, Judge Katsas, is found there, as is our authority for our four other arguments as to why ATCA can't apply here. I recognize I'm out of time, but I would just ask
you,
to be able
why
to
you make what's your strongest. We've read the pleadings, but if you want to make the strongest argument.
I think first and foremost, there's seven different reasons why, as a matter of statutory construction, a statute that says in this relevant portion, statute is effective upon the date of enactment. The Supreme Court in Landgraf said a statute that says it is effective upon enactment doesn't mean any retroactive application. There's no unambiguous directive.
Does that presume the application of the retroactivity presumption?
No, that's just the statutory interpretation part of Landgraf. Landgraf separately says, which would be my first point, there is no unambiguous directive requiring retroactive application. I'm starting here because of the constitutional avoidance doctrine, Your Honor. I don't actually believe our constitutional arguments are weaker than the statutory construction ones, but there's no unambiguous directive for retroactive application. Number two, even if there were any ambiguity, which I'm sure Mr. McAllister will say, you know, there was this kind of intent and it could be read this way, it's quite clear that ambiguity doesn't help them. In the Lind case, what the Supreme Court said was it has to be perfectly clear that there's retroactive application. Ambiguity works against them, not in their favor. There's no rule of lenity here that will allow ambiguity.
But if we regard this as a jurisdictional and therefore procedural statute as to which there is no constitutional question, then we don't have to do any avoidance. You only do avoidance if you think there's something to be avoided.
Well, with respect, that would require contradicting the panel's decision in Livnot, which made it crystal clear that there is a substantive, not a procedural right under due process to be free of jurisdiction in a forum where the defendant is not at home. That is not a procedural rule. That's not a subject matter jurisdiction rule. That is precisely what ATCA tries to undo. But that's a substantive right because if it's not a substantive right, then LIVNOT doesn't mean what it says, which is when this court said in LIVNOT, Congress can't wish away a constitutional provision, can't wish away the substantive right under the Due Process Clause to be free from jurisdiction in the United States where it's not at home. So that's another reason under our seven reasons of statutory construction.
Well, LIVNOT didn't address the question of waiver, of freely of knowingly and freely waiving, did it? LIVNOT did not address the jurisdictional hook there was general jurisdiction. That wouldn't be the jurisdictional hook here. The question here is whether Congress, through this act, can provide jurisdiction on contingent on acceptance of money.
I'm thrilled Your Honor asked me that question because that frames the unconstitutional conditions doctrine and why it applies here. LIVNOT says it's a substantive enumerated constitutional right to be free under the Due Process Clause from jurisdiction. What Congress is saying, if you want aid, you've got to surrender that constitutional right. That is precisely what the unconstitutional conditions doctrine cases say Congress can't do, and I respectfully refer the court to Justice Alito's opinion in the Kuntz case, which says, you know what, every time we go through unconstitutional conditions, somebody says, it's okay, because we don't have to give you this benefit. It's an act of legislative grace. It's a gratuity. And what
Congress surely has more latitude when they're addressing funding conditions than when they're imposing direct requirements.
Only when what they seek to do is either withhold funding or provide it. Your Honor is absolutely right.
What's wrong with Congress saying that when we spend our foreign assistance money, to which no one has an entitlement, we want only people who have renounced terrorism and are making amends for any past terrorist acts.
And that crystallizes the distinction between what the previous statutes have done, which have said, if we're not satisfied that you're behaving the way we want, you get no aid. Congress may do that.
Right.
What Congress may not do, and what Kuntz said, is every one of our unconstitutional conditions cases deals with gratuitous government benefits. But just because the government doesn't have to give it to you doesn't mean that it can make you surrender an enumerated constitutional.
But it's a sufficient answer to an unconstitutional conditions objection to say that the condition advances the purpose of the spending program.
Respectfully, I disagree, because the cases that support that analysis, Your Honor, which are rational relationship cases, all deal with non-enumerated rights under the Constitution. The unconstitutional conditions doctrine says, not when you get to enumerated rights. This is what Kuntz says. When it comes to enumerated rights under the Constitution, it doesn't matter that the government has a legitimate, rational relationship to this goal. They simply can't ask for it. It's a bargain on which the government cannot insist. And that's the distinction between those cases.
Other questions? Questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Any time? Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd like to address a few points made by opposing counsel. One point was Judge Katsas was asking a question about prejudice, and counsel stated, although I think Judge Katsas understood where the prejudice arose from, but opposing counsel stated again that we had 5 years of discovery and that was our chance. The point is that Judge Freeman made his requests about the specific jurisdiction test, and the Daimler case was imposed after the 5 years of discovery. We didn't have any discovery on the connections between the terror campaign in and near Israel and the influence campaign which was occurring in the United States. Secondly, regarding the...
But he did at some point ask you, what are the subjects on which you want further discovery?
Yes, Your Honor.
Right, and you did not identify the missing link under LIVNOT, which is the connection between the particular attack and attempts to influence United States policy.
Your Honor, in our briefs, we made a different jurisdictional discovery request in the light of LIVNOT. In our jurisdictional discovery requests in our briefs, we address 2 points. One is, was the PA, through the AAMB, deliberately targeting Americans and killing Americans, launching attacks against Americans? And two was, what are the external communications by the PA and the PLO regarding those attacks on the Americans? Because this goes to the heart of the conspiracy that is at issue in this case.
So those are different than the two requests listed at A142?
Yes, Your Honor. They are different than the requests listed at the district court. We made
In what form? I'm sorry. What format were these additional requests made?
We articulated a more expansive view of the jurisdictional discovery in the briefs.
In the district court?
In the briefs in this court.
Yeah, but in the district court.
In the district court, we requested jurisdictional discovery less sophisticated than the requests that we described at the appellate court level.
And why should we not cut that off as a new argument first raised on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, the court has discretion to review pure questions of law, and it's been well briefed by both sides, thus there's less prejudice.
Pure questions of law, but this is about the nitty-gritty of what you're seeking, the subjects on which you're seeking discovery and why.
Yes, Your Honor, but in this case, the LibNet decision is an intervening event, and we had to address the LibNet decision.
And remind me, when did LibNet come down relative to the procedural history of this case?
LibNet was decided by this court last year in 2017.
After...
And the judge,
long after the close of the discovery.
Long after.
Yeah.
The judge's decision is in 2015?
2015, yes, Your Honor. And I see that I'm out of time.
Further questions? Thank you. We'll take that on this mission.
Thank you.
This honorable court is adjourned.